he boarded a steamer bound for Hooker's headquarters, a grim counterpoint to his joyous April visit. Once again, Lincoln found some redemption in the resolute determination of his troops. "All accounts agree," one reporter wrote from Army headquarters, "that the troops on the Rappahannock came out of their late bloody fight game to the backbone. Though fresh from all the horrors of the battlefield, with ranks decimated and almost exhausted with exposure and fatigue, they remained undaunted and erect, composed and ready to turn on the instant and follow their leaders back into the fray." Moreover, while the Confederates had lost 4,000 fewer men, their casualty list of 13,000 represented a larger percentage of their total forces. In addition, they had lost one of their greatest generals, Thomas Stonewall Jackson. Returning from a reconnaissance mission, Jackson had been mistaken for an enemy and was fired upon by some of his own men. His left arm was amputated in a nearby field hospital, but he died of pneumonia 8 days later. The South went into mourning. "Since the death of Washington," the Richmond Whig proclaimed, "no similar event has so profoundly and sorrowfully impressed the people of Virginia as the death of Jackson." Lincoln remained at Army headquarters for only a few hours. Before leaving, he handed Hooker a letter expressing confidence in the continuing campaign. "If possible," the president wrote, "I would be very glad of another movement early enough to give us some benefit from the fact of the enemy's communications being broken. But neither for this reason or any other do I wish anything done in desperation or rashness." Lincoln made it clear that he stood ready to assist Hooker in the development of a new plan of action. As he had done so many times before, Lincoln withstood the storm of defeat by replacing anguish over an unchangeable past with hope in an uncharted future. Chapter 20. The Tycoon is in Fine Whack. No sooner had Lincoln returned from his May 7th visit to the troops than he was confronted by a colossal political uproar over the arrest and imprisonment of former Ohio Congressman Clement Vallandigham on the charge of treason. The arrest was ordered by General Burnside, who had assumed command of the Department of the Ohio after his replacement by Hooker. Responding to tumultuous peace demonstrations, where speakers openly advocated the defeat of the Union's cause, Burnside issued General Orders No. 38, proclaiming that "the habit of declaring sympathy for the enemy will not be allowed in this department. All persons committing treason, expressed or implied, would be arrested and tried by a military court." In deliberate defiance, Vallandigham incited a large crowd to a frenzy with his passionate denunciations of a failed war. This demagogue of defeat railed that the conflict would end only if soldiers deserted en masse, and the people acted to hurl King Lincoln from his throne. After reading a transcript of Vallandigham's remarks, Burnside sent his soldiers to arrest him at his home in the middle of the night. "The door resisted the efforts of the soldiers," a local journalist wrote, "and Vallandigham flourished a revolver at the window and fired two or three shots, but the soldiers made their entry through a side entrance." With unprecedented speed, a military tribunal found him guilty and sentenced him to prison for the remainder of the war. His application for a writ of habeas corpus was denied. When the Chicago Times exacerbated the incident with its incendiary coverage, Burnside, on his own authority, shut the paper down. Learning of these events in the morning newspaper, Lincoln found himself in a difficult position. While he later admitted that the news of the arrest brought him pain, he felt compelled to uphold Burnside. Nonetheless, he anticipated the damaging political fallout. Criticism came not only from Copperheads and Democrats, but from loyal Republicans. Thurlow Weed deplored the arrest. Senator Trumbull warned Browning that if such arbitrary arrests continued, the civil tribunals will be completely subordinated to the military and the government overthrown. A friend of Seward cautioned him that, by a large and honest portion of the community, the arrest was considered an invasion of a great principle, the right of free speech, and that it might well precipitate civil war within the loyal states. Seward agreed. Indeed, in a moment of rare accord, every member of the cabinet united in opposition to the Vallandigham arrest. Lincoln, searching for compromise, publicly supported Vallandigham's arrest, but commuted the sentence to banishment within the Confederate lines. There, it was playfully remarked, his copperhead body could go where his heart already was. The New York Times recorded general satisfaction at the solution, which so happily meets the difficulties of the case, avoiding the possibility of making him a martyr, and yet effectually destroying his power for evil. Escorted by Union cavalry holding a flag of truce, Vallandigham was removed to Tennessee. In an act that further diminished his reputation, he quickly escaped to Canada. Meanwhile, Stanton revoked Burnside's suspension of the Chicago Times and informed local officials that they were not to suppress newspapers. Thus, Lincoln was able to maintain his support for General Burnside while minimizing any violation of civil liberties necessitated by war. Asked months later by a radical to suppress the infamous Chicago Times, Lincoln told her, "I fear you do not fully comprehend the danger of abridging the liberties of the people. Nothing but the very sternest necessity can ever justify it. A government had better go to the very extreme of toleration than to do aught that could be construed into an interference with, or to jeopardize in any degree, the common rights of its citizens." After he dealt with Vallandigham, Lincoln's next priority was to comfort Burnside. Upon hearing that the entire cabinet had opposed his action, the general had offered to resign. Lincoln not only refused the resignation, but insisted that while the cabinet regretted the necessity of the arrest, once it was done, all were for seeing you through with it. Finally, knowing that the public would ultimately be the judge of the administration's actions on the home front, Lincoln began drafting a document that would put the complex matter of military arrests into perspective. He had contemplated the subject for months, but his delineation of his ideas assumed new urgency with the public outrage at the arrest of Vallandigham. "Often an idea about it would occur to me, which seemed to have force, and make perfect answer to some of the things that were said and written about my actions," he later told a visitor. "I never let one of those ideas escape me, but wrote it on a scrap of paper." Now he would have to cobble those scraps into a cogent argument that the American public would accept. Furthermore, Lincoln needed the proper forum in which to present his ideas. It came in late May, when a meeting of New York Democrats passed a set of resolutions condemning his military arrests as unconstitutional. Lincoln's extensive response to the Democratic resolutions took less time than any other of like importance, because he had already studied it from every side. In early June, the president read his draft to the cabinet. "It has vigor and ability," a delighted Wells noted. Blair advised the president to emphasize that "we are struggling against a conspiracy to put down popular government." Blair realized that Lincoln had often reiterated this theme, but, as Thomas Hart Benton used to say, the ding-dong proved to be the best figure in rhetoric. The finished letter, addressed to New York Democrat Erastus Corning, was released to the New York Tribune on June 12th. conceding that in ordinary times military arrests would be unconstitutional, Lincoln reminded his critics that the Constitution specifically provided for the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus in cases of rebellion or invasion. He went on to say that Vallandigham was not arrested for his criticism of the administration, but because he was laboring with some effect to prevent the raising of troops, to encourage desertions from the army, and to leave the rebellion without an adequate military force to suppress it. Pointing out that long experience has shown that armies cannot be maintained unless desertion shall be punished by the severe penalty of death, Lincoln posed a question that was soon echoed by supporters everywhere. Must I shoot a simple-minded soldier boy who deserts, while I must not touch a hair of a wily agitator who induces him to desert? This is none the less injurious when effected by getting a father or brother or friend into a public meeting and there working upon his feelings till he is persuaded to write the soldier boy that he is fighting in a bad cause for a wicked administration of a contemptible government too weak to arrest and punish him if he shall desert. The president's letter garnered extravagant praise throughout the North. It is full, candid, clear, and conclusive, the New York Times affirmed. Even Democrats were impressed. While Edward Everett told Lincoln he would not have advocated Vallandigham's arrest, he considered the president's defense of the step complete. Supporters were thrilled. It is a grand document, strong, plain, simple, without one sparkle of tinsel ornament, Stoddard enthused, yet dignified, as becomes the ruler of a great people when the nation is listening to what he says. It should be printed in every northern paper and read by every citizen. In fact, Lincoln took every step to ensure that his words would shape public opinion. Printed in a great variety of formats, the letter eventually reached an astonishing 10 million people in their homes and workplaces, on isolated farms, and in the cities. And as the American people absorbed the logic of Lincoln's argument, popular sentiment began to shift. With the approach of summer, the tempers of the cabinet ministers grew shorter. Wells noted with disapproval that Stanton attended only half the cabinet meetings and said little when present. Not unfrequently he has a private conference with the president in the corner of the room, or with Seward in the library, griped Wells. Seward, too, would turn up when a session commenced, speak privately with the president, then leave his son, Fred Seward, to represent his department. Stanton, who claimed he would never raise any important question when an assistant is present, was infuriated. Blair, frustrated by the superior access granted Seward and Stanton, often lingered after cabinet meetings in hopes of a private word with Lincoln. At such a time as this, it would seem there should be free, full, and constant intercourse and interchange of views, fumed Wells. Bates, also discontented, agreed. There is now no mutual confidence among the members of the government, and really no such thing as a CC, Cabinet Council, he grumbled. The more ambitious members who seek to control, Seward, Chase, Stanton, never start their projects in CC, but try first to commit the president, and then, if possible, secure the apparent consent of the members. Chase found the lack of collective deliberation demeaning. "But how idle it seems to me to speculate on military affairs," he complained to David Dudley Field. "The president consults only Stanton and Halleck in the management of the war. I look on from the outside, and as well as I can furnish the means." If he were president, Chase assured Congressman Garfield, surely he would have a system of information which should at least keep my Secretary of the Treasury advised of everything of importance. More strongly than Chase, Blair decried the lack of more formal meetings, attributing the cabinet's failings to the machinations of Seward and Stanton. They had also been responsible, he believed, for Lincoln's unwillingness to replace Halleck, whom Blair despised, and restore McClellan. In Blair's mind, both Seward and Chase were scheming for the succession. Stanton would cut the president's throat if he could. Blair's hatred for Stanton was so virulent that he refused to set foot in the War Department, the primary source of military information. Talking with Wells one evening at the depot, Blair admitted that Lincoln's behavior puzzled him. "Strange, strange," he exclaimed, "that the president, who has sterling ability, should give himself over so completely to Stanton and Seward." Certainly, Lincoln was not oblivious to the infighting of his colleagues. He remained firmly convinced, however, that so long as each continued to do his own job well, no changes need be made. Moreover, he had no desire for contentious cabinet discussions on tactical matters, preferring to rely on the trusted counsel of Seward and Stanton. Still, he understood the resentment this provoked in neglected members of his administration, and through many small acts of generosity, he managed to keep the respect and affection of his disgruntled colleagues. Recognizing Blair's desire for more personal influence, Lincoln kept his door open to both Monty and his father. Monty Blair, despite his frustrations, was ultimately loyal and had accomplished marvels as Postmaster General, utterly transforming a primitive postal system without letter carriers, mailboxes on streets, or free delivery. Modernizing the postal service was particularly important for the soldiers, who relied on letters, newspapers, and magazines from home to sustain morale. To this end, Blair created a special system of army post offices, complete with army postmasters and stamp agents. His innovations provided the means for soldiers to send mail without postage, so long as the recipient paid 3 cents on delivery of each letter. Even when foul weather and muddy roads made the delivery of mails to the army camps nearly impossible, inordinate efforts allowed the mail to get through. Lincoln was also careful to reserve time for private conversation with Wells. He would often catch up with his Neptune on the pathway leading from the White House to the War and Navy Departments, or call him aside as they awaited news in the telegraph office. In his written correspondence, the president was equally thoughtful. When he felt compelled to issue Wells an order regarding the instructions of naval officers at neutral ports, he assured Wells that "It is not intended to be insinuated that you have been remiss in the performance of the arduous and responsible duties of your department, which I take pleasure in affirming has in your hands been conducted with admirable success." So, in the end, the feuding cabinet members, with the exception of Chase, remained loyal to their president, who met rivalry and irritability with kindness and diffused their tensions with humor. A particularly bitter argument arose between Chase and Monty Blair when Blair claimed that the fugitive slave law still applied in loyal states and should be employed to return a runaway to his owner. Chase demanded instead that the slave be placed into military service. Lincoln mediated the dispute, assuring them both that this very issue had long bedeviled him. "It reminded him," Wells recorded in his diary, "of a man in Illinois who was in debt and terribly annoyed by a pressing creditor, until finally the debtor assumed to be crazy whenever the creditor broached the subject. I," said the president, "have on more than one occasion, in this room, when beset by extremists on this question, been compelled to appear to be very mad." During another tense session, Lincoln cited the work of the humorist Orpheus Kerr, which he especially relished, even though it often lampooned him and the members of the cabinet. "Now the hits that are given to you, Mr. Wells, or to Chase, I can enjoy," but I dare say they may have disgusted you while I was laughing at them. So, vice versa, as regards myself. While working to sustain the spirits of his cabinet, Lincoln also tried to soothe the incessant bickering and occasional resentment among his generals. Learning that William Rosecrans, headquartered in Nashville, had taken umbrage at a note he had sent, Lincoln replied at once, "In no case have I intended to censure you or to question your ability," he wrote. "I frequently make mistakes myself in the many things I am compelled to do hastily." He had merely intended to express concern over Rosecrans's action regarding a particular colonel. And when Lincoln felt compelled to remove General Samuel Curtis from command in Missouri, he assured him that his removal was necessary only to somehow break up the state of things in Missouri, where Governor Gamble headed one quarreling faction and Curtis another. "I did not mean to cast any censure upon you, nor to endorse any of the charges made against you by others. With me, the presumption is still in your favor that you are honest, capable, faithful, and patriotic." Despite Lincoln's diplomacy, the quarrels in Missouri continued, eliciting a note from Governor Gamble complaining that the language in one of Lincoln's published letters had been grossly offensive to him. When Hay presented the note to Lincoln, he was told to put it away. Lincoln explained to Gamble that as he was trying to preserve his own temper by avoiding irritants so far as practicable, he had decided not to read what his secretary had described as a cross letter. Having made his point, Lincoln assured the wounded Gamble, "I was totally unconscious of any malice or disrespect towards you, or of using any expression which should offend you." Lincoln's patience had its limits, however. When Major General Robert H. Milroy railed about the blind, unreasoning hatred of Halleck that he claimed had supposedly led to his suspension from command, Lincoln was unyielding. "I have scarcely seen anything from you at any time that did not contain imputations against your superiors," Lincoln replied. "You have constantly urged the idea that you were persecuted because you did not come from West Point, and you repeat it in these letters. This, my dear general, is, I fear, the rock on which you have split." Likewise, when Rosecrans grumbled that his request for a predated commission to secure a higher rank had been denied, Lincoln was unsympathetic. "Truth to speak, I do not appreciate this matter of rank on paper, as you officers do. The world will not forget that you fought the Battle of Stone River, and it will never care a fig whether you rank General Grant on paper, or he so ranks you." As he was forced to deal with quarreling generals on almost every front, it is little wonder that Lincoln developed such respect and admiration for Ulysses S. Grant. Steadily and uncomplainingly, Grant had advanced toward Vicksburg, the Confederate stronghold whose capture would give the Union control of the Mississippi River and split the Confederacy. By the middle of May, after five successive victories, Grant had come within striking distance of Vicksburg. After two direct assaults against John Pemberton's forces failed on May 19th and May 22nd, he settled into a siege designed to starve the Confederates out. "Whether General Grant shall or shall not consummate the capture of Vicksburg," Lincoln wrote a friend on May 26th, "his campaign from the beginning of this month up to the 22nd day of it is one of the most brilliant in the world." During the troubling weeks with Hooker's army in the east, news from Grant's army in the west had sustained Lincoln. In March, Stanton had sent Charles Dana, the newspaper man who would later become Assistant Secretary of War, to observe General Grant and report on his movements. Dana had developed a powerful respect for Grant that was evident in his long, detailed dispatches. Lincoln's own estimation of his general steadily increased, as reports revealed a terse man of character and action. requesting that General Banks join forces with him in the final drive to open the Mississippi, Grant assured Banks that he would gladly serve under him as his superior in rank, or simply cooperate with him for the benefit of the common cause if he should prefer that course. While working to sustain the spirits of his cabinet, Lincoln also tried to soothe the incessant bickering and occasional resentment among his generals. Learning that William Rosecrans, headquartered in Nashville, had taken umbrage at a note he had sent, Lincoln replied at once, "In no case have I intended to censure you or to question your ability," he wrote. "I frequently make mistakes myself in the many things I am compelled to do hastily." He had merely intended to express concern over Rosecrans's action regarding a particular colonel. And when Lincoln felt compelled to remove General Samuel Curtis from command in Missouri, he assured him that his removal was necessary only to somehow break up the state of things in Missouri, where Governor Gamble headed one quarreling faction and Curtis another. "I did not mean to cast any censure upon you, nor to endorse any of the charges made against you by others. With me, the presumption is still in your favor that you are honest, capable, faithful, and patriotic." Despite Lincoln's diplomacy, the quarrels in Missouri continued, eliciting a note from Governor Gamble complaining that the language in one of Lincoln's published letters had been grossly offensive to him. When Hay presented the note to Lincoln, he was told to put it away. Lincoln explained to Gamble that as he was trying to preserve his own temper by avoiding irritants so far as practicable, he had decided not to read what his secretary had described as a cross letter. Having made his point, Lincoln assured the wounded Gamble, "I was totally unconscious of any malice or disrespect towards you, or of using any expression which should offend you." Lincoln's patience had its limits, however. When Major General Robert H. Milroy railed about the blind, unreasoning hatred of Halleck that he claimed had supposedly led to his suspension from command, Lincoln was unyielding. "I have scarcely seen anything from you at any time that did not contain imputations against your superiors," Lincoln replied. "You have constantly urged the idea that you were persecuted because you did not come from West Point, and you repeat it in these letters. This, my dear general, is, I fear, the rock on which you have split." Likewise, when Rosecrans grumbled that his request for a predated commission to secure a higher rank had been denied, Lincoln was unsympathetic. "Truth to speak, I do not appreciate this matter of rank on paper, as you officers do. The world will not forget that you fought the Battle of Stone River, and it will never care a fig whether you rank General Grant on paper, or he so ranks you." As he was forced to deal with quarreling generals on almost every front, it is little wonder that Lincoln developed such respect and admiration for Ulysses S. Grant. Steadily and uncomplainingly, Grant had advanced toward Vicksburg, the Confederate stronghold whose capture would give the Union control of the Mississippi River and split the Confederacy. By the middle of May, after five successive victories, Grant had come within striking distance of Vicksburg. After two direct assaults against John Pemberton's forces failed on May 19th and May 22nd, he settled into a siege designed to starve the Confederates out. "Whether General Grant shall or shall not consummate the capture of Vicksburg," Lincoln wrote a friend on May 26th, "his campaign from the beginning of this month up to the 22nd day of it is one of the most brilliant in the world." During the troubling weeks with Hooker's army in the east, news from Grant's army in the west had sustained Lincoln. In March, Stanton had sent Charles Dana, the newspaper man who would later become Assistant Secretary of War, to observe General Grant and report on his movements. Dana had developed a powerful respect for Grant that was evident in his long, detailed dispatches. Lincoln's own estimation of his general steadily increased, as reports revealed a terse man of character and action. Requesting that General Banks join forces with him in the final drive to open the Mississippi, Grant assured Banks that he would gladly serve under him as his superior in rank, or simply cooperate with him for the benefit of the common cause if he should prefer that course. Despite his growing regard for Grant, there were instances that required Lincoln to intervene with his most successful general. In a misguided effort to stop peddlers from illegally profiteering in cotton in areas penetrated by Union armies, Grant had issued an order expelling the Jews as a class from his department. The discriminatory order, which contained no provision for individual hearings or trials, forced all Jewish people to depart within 24 hours, leaving horses, carriages, and other valuables behind. When a delegation of Jewish leaders approached Lincoln, it was clear that he was not fully informed about the matter. He responded to their plight with a biblical allusion. "And so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan?" The delegation leader answered, "Yes, and that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection." Lincoln replied quickly, "And this protection they shall have at once." He took his pen and wrote a note to Halleck, ordering immediate cancellation of the order. Halleck reluctantly complied, after assuring Grant that "the President has no objection to your expelling traitors and Jew peddlers, which I suppose was the object of your order, but as it in terms proscribed an entire religious class, some of whom are fighting in our ranks, the President deemed it necessary to revoke it." Lincoln was also confronted by continuing rumors of Grant's relapse into excessive drinking. Tales of drunkenness were not confined to Grant. Elizabeth Blair heard that during the Battle of Chancellorsville, Hooker was drunk all the time, while Bates was told that General H. Halleck was a confirmed opium eater, a habit that contributed to his watery eyes and bloated appearance. In Grant's case, the gossip reached Lincoln by way of the puritanical Chase, who had received a letter from Murat Halstead. The respected journalist warned Chase that Grant was most of the time more than half drunk, and much of the time idiotically drunk. In fact, Lincoln and Stanton had already heard similar complaints. After dispatching investigators to look into General Grant's behavior, however, they had concluded that his drinking did not affect his unmatched ability to plan, execute, and win battles. A memorable story circulated that when a delegation brought further rumors of Grant's drinking to the President, Lincoln declared that if he could find the brand of whiskey Grant used, he would promptly distribute it to the rest of his generals. While the siege of Vicksburg tightened in the West, a deceptive quiet settled on the Rappahannock. After visiting Hooker's headquarters in mid-May, Senators Wade and Chandler told Lincoln that the pickets on both sides of the river had resumed their old pastime of bandying wit and repartee. "I say, Yank," shouted over one of the rebels, "where is Fightin' Joe Hooker now?" "Oh, he's gone to Stonewall Jackson's funeral," shouted Yank in reply. During this interlude on the Eastern Front, Seward accompanied Francis and Fanny back to Auburn, where they were planning to spend the summer. For a few precious days he entertained old friends, caught up on his reading, and tended his garden. The sole trying event was the decision to fell a favorite old poplar tree that had grown unsound. Francis could not bear to be present as it was cut, certain that she should feel every stroke of the axe. Once it was over, however, she could relax in the beautiful garden she had sorely missed during her prolonged stay in Washington. On June 1st, when Seward boarded the train to return to the capital, Fanny wrote that their home seemed very lonely without him. No sooner had Seward departed Auburn than Frances and Fanny began hearing troubling rumors that Lee intended to invade Washington, Maryland, or Pennsylvania. "We have again been anxious about Washington," Fanny told her father. "Although I don't consider myself a protection, Washington seems safer to me when I am there." Reassuring his daughter, Seward noted that during his stay in Auburn, he too had remained in constant uneasiness over all manner of rumors that proved groundless upon his return to the capital. "Certainly the last thing that anyone here thinks of nowadays is an invasion of Washington." On Monday, June 8th, Mary and Tad left the capital for a 2-week vacation in Philadelphia, where they took a suite at the Continental Hotel. After they had gone, Wells spoke with Lincoln about a delicate matter concerning Mary. In the aftermath of Willie's death the previous year, she had canceled the weekly Marine Band summer concerts on the White House lawn. Wells warned that if the public were deprived of the entertainment for yet another season, the grumbling and discontent of the previous summer would only increase. Lincoln hesitated at first. Willie had loved the weekly concerts with their picnic-like festivities, but Mrs. L. would not consent, certainly not until after the 4th of July. When Wells persisted, Lincoln finally agreed to let him do whatever he thought best. That night, most likely unsettled by the conversation about Willie, Lincoln had a nightmare about Tad's recently acquired revolver. "Think you better put Tad's pistol away," he wired Mary the next morning. "I had an ugly dream about him." In the days that followed, reports that Lee's army was heading north through the Shenandoah Valley to invade Maryland and Pennsylvania multiplied. On June 15th, Seward sent a telegram to his son Will, suggesting he had better cut short his leave to return to his regiment in Washington. "Oh, what a disappointment," Fanny lamented. Will had just arrived in Auburn for a 20-day sojourn with both his own family and Jenny's. Many plans would be canceled, including a double family picnic to the lake. Writing to Frances that same day, Seward sought to set her mind at ease. Though it now seemed certain that Lee had crossed the Rappahannock, she must not infer that there is any increase of danger for any of us in this change. On the contrary, the near approach of battles toward us brings disadvantages to the enemy and adds to our strength. In similar fashion, Lincoln reassured Mary when a headline in a northern paper blared, "Invasion! Rebel forces in Maryland and Pennsylvania!" "It is a matter of choice with yourself whether you come home," he told her. "I do not think the raid into Pennsylvania amounts to anything at all." When each day brought reports of further Confederate advances, however, Mary decided to rejoin her husband in Washington. "The country now is in a blaze of excitement," Benjamin French recorded on June 18th. "Some of the rebel troops have crossed into the upper part of Pennsylvania, and the North is wide awake." While Wells worried that something of a panic pervades the city, Lincoln remained quietly confident that the Union troops, fighting on home ground, would achieve the signal victory so long denied. Capitalizing on the intense patriotism inspired by the invasion, he called out 100,000 troops from the militias in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Ohio, and the new state of West Virginia. "I should think this constant toil and moil would kill him," French marveled, yet the resilient president seemed in excellent spirits. Inspired by Lincoln's steadfast nature, French added, "The more I see of him, the more I am convinced of his superlative goodness, truth, kindness, and patriotism." In the tense atmosphere of Washington, the committee charged with planning the 4th of July celebrations considered suspending their preparations. "Don't you stop," Mary Lincoln ordered White House Secretary William Stoddard, promising to personally help make the anniversary celebrations a success. Reflecting her husband's unruffled confidence, she assured Stoddard of her husband's certainty that the crisis has come and that all the chances are on our side. This move of Lee's is all he could ask for. Lincoln's primary concern was that Hooker would again be outgeneraled by Lee. His worry escalated in the last weeks of June when he observed in Hooker the same failings that were witnessed in McClellan after the Battle of Antietam: a want of alacrity to obey, and a greedy call for more troops which could not and ought not to be taken from other points. When Hooker delivered a prickly telegram asking to be relieved of command, Lincoln and Stanton replaced him with General George Meade, who had participated in the Peninsula Campaign, Second Bull Run, and Chancellorsville. The surprising move distressed Chase. He had long championed Hooker, and had recently returned from spending the day with him in the field. When Lincoln informed his cabinet that the change was already accomplished, Wells noted that Chase was disturbed more than he cared should appear. The following day, Chase wrote to Kate, who was in New York, "You must have been greatly astonished for the relieving of General Hooker, but your astonishment cannot have exceeded mine." Three days later, in Pennsylvania, the three-day Battle of Gettysburg began. "The turning point of the whole war seems to be crowding itself into the present," wrote John Nicolay. "It seems almost impossible to wait for the result. Hours become days, and days become months in such a suspense." If Lee achieved victory at Gettysburg, he could move on to Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington. His aura of invincibility might, it was feared, eventually lead the British and French to recognize the independence of the Confederacy and bring the war to an end. Telegraph service from the front was poor and desultory, according to operator David Bates. Lincoln remained a constant fixture in the telegraph office, resting fitfully on the couch. At intervals, Stanton, Seward, Wells, and Senators Sumner and Chandler drifted in and out. Senator Chandler would never forget the painful anxiety of those few days, when the fate of the nation seemed to hang in the balance, nor the restless solicitude of Mr. Lincoln as he paced up and down the room, reading dispatches, soliloquizing, and often stopping to trace the map which hung on the wall. Sketched on the map were the generals and places that would later be engraved in history: James Longstreet and George Pickett, Winfield Hancock and Joshua Chamberlain, Little Round Top and Cemetery Ridge. After inconclusive fighting on the first day, a dispatch from Meade on Thursday night, July 2nd, reported that, after one of the severest contests of the war, the rebels had been repulsed at all points. Still, given recent reversals and the protracted uncertainty in the present, everyone held their breath. As of 9 p.m. the following night, the New York Times reported, "No reliable advices have been received here from the Pennsylvania battlefield. It is generally felt that this is the crisis of the war. Intense anxiety prevails." At midnight, a messenger handed Wells a telegram from a Connecticut editor named Byington, who had left the battlefield a few hours earlier and reported that everything looked hopeful. Wells assured Lincoln that Byington was reliable, but the hours of uncertainty continued until shortly after dawn, July 4th, when a telegram from Meade reported that the battle had been successfully concluded. The rebels were withdrawing after severe losses. Casualties were later calculated at 28,000, nearly a third of Lee's army. General Abner Doubleday described the tenacious fighting, which cost 23,000 Union lives, as being the most desperate which ever took place in the world. He told a reporter that nothing can picture the horrors of the battlefield around the ruined city of Gettysburg. Each house, church, hovel, and barn is filled with the wounded of both armies. The ground is covered with the dead. On the morning of the 4th of July, Lincoln issued a celebratory press release that was carried by telegram across the country. For young Fanny Seward, waiting anxiously in Auburn, the day had started as the gloomiest 4th she had ever known. No public demonstration here, no ringing of bells. Everything changed in the late afternoon when the extra arrived, carrying the tidings of victory. Fireworks were set off to glorify simultaneously the country's independence and the long-awaited victory. In New York City, George Templeton Strong exulted in the colorful newspaper accounts of Lee's retreat. "The results of this victory are priceless," he wrote. "Government is strengthened fourfold at home and abroad. Gold 138 today, and government securities rising. Copperheads are palsied and dumb, for the moment at least." Triumphant news from Vicksburg followed on the heels of victory at Gettysburg. Grant's 46-day siege had finally forced Pemberton to surrender his starving troops. Wells had received the first tiding that Vicksburg had surrendered to Grant in a dispatch from Admiral David Porter. The bespectacled, slightly fossilized Wells hurried to the White House, dispatch in hand. Reaching the room where Lincoln was talking with Chase and several others, Wells reportedly executed a double shuffle and threw up his hat by way of showing that he was the bearer of glad tidings. Lincoln affirmed that he never before nor afterward saw Mr. Wells so thoroughly excited as he was then. "The elated president caught my hand," recorded Wells, "and throwing his arm around me, exclaimed, 'What can we do for the Secretary of the Navy for this glorious intelligence? He is always giving us good news. I cannot in words tell you my joy over this result. It is great, Mr. Wells, it is great.'" With the fall of Vicksburg, as Lincoln later said, "the father of waters again goes unvexed to the sea." Dana described the surrender in a telegram to Stanton the next day. "The rebel troops marched out and stacked arms in front of their works, while General Pemberton appeared for a moment with his staff upon the parapet of the central post. No troops remained outside. Everything quiet here. Grant entered the city at 11 o'clock and was received by Pemberton, whom he treated with great courtesy and dignity. Dana estimated the number of prisoners, for whom rations were being distributed, to be about 30,000. Lincoln expressed his joyful appreciation to Grant in a remarkable letter. "I write this now as a grateful acknowledgment for the almost inestimable service you have done the country," he began. He conceded that while he had approved most of the general's maneuvers during the long struggle, he had harbored misgivings over Grant's decision to turn northward east of the Big Black instead of joining General Banks. "I now wish to make the personal acknowledgment that you were right and I was wrong." Word of Vicksburg's surrender unleashed wild celebrations throughout the North. In Washington, a large crowd, led by the 34th Massachusetts Regimental Band, formed at the National Hotel and marched to the White House to congratulate the president. Lincoln appeared before the cheering multitude, revealing the preliminary thoughts that would coalesce in his historic Gettysburg Address. "How long is it? 80-odd years, since on the 4th of July, for the first time in the history of the world, a nation, by its representatives, assembled and declared as a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. He went on to recall the signal events that had shared the anniversary of the nation's birth, beginning with the twin deaths of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams on July 4th, and ending with the Union's twin victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg on the same day. "Gentlemen," the president declared, "this is a glorious theme, and the occasion for a speech, but I am not prepared to make one worthy of the occasion." Instead, he spoke of the praise due to the many brave officers and soldiers who have fought in the cause of the Union. The band played some patriotic airs, and the crowd pressed on to the War Department, where Stanton paid generous tribute to General Grant. Although several more speeches followed and songs were played, the people had not exhausted their euphoria. Marching to Lafayette Square, they joined another throng at Seward's house, cheering for the secretary to appear. The indefatigable Seward happily obliged, delivering a long, animated speech, tracing the conflict from its troubled early days to its recent triumphs, which, he assured them, foretold the beginning of the end. The following day, little work was accomplished in the offices of government. In every building, Noah Brooks reported, the official bulletins were read over and over again, producing cheer upon cheer from the crowds of officers and clerks. On the streets, Union men were shaking hands wherever they met, like friends after a long absence, while the Copperheads had retired to their holes like evil beasts at sunrise. The joyous occasion was marred for the Lincolns by a serious carriage accident that took place on the second day of the Gettysburg Battle. As Rebecca Pomeroy related the events, the Lincolns were returning to the White House from the Soldiers' Home. Lincoln was riding on horseback, while Mary followed behind in their carriage. The night before, presumably targeting the president, an unknown assailant had removed the screws fastening the driver's seat to the body of the carriage. When the vehicle began to descend from a winding hill, the seat came loose, throwing the driver to the ground. Unable to restrain the runaway horses, Mary tried to leap from the carriage. She landed on her back, hitting her head against a sharp stone. The wound was dressed at a nearby hospital, but a dangerous infection set in that kept her incapacitated for several weeks. With the Battle of Gettysburg in full swing, Lincoln was unable to minister to Mary's needs. He brought Mrs. Pomeroy to the Soldiers' Home to nurse his wife round the clock. Robert Lincoln believed that his mother never quite recovered from the effects of her fall, which exacerbated the debilitating headaches that she already endured. In the wake of the triumphs at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, Lincoln anticipated a quick end to the rebellion. General Meade, he told Halleck, had only to complete his work, so gloriously prosecuted thus far, by the literal or substantial destruction of Lee's army. In the days that followed, both Halleck and Lincoln urged Meade to go after Lee, to attack him vigorously, to capture his army before he could escape into Virginia. Robert Lincoln later said that his father had sent explicit orders to Meade, directing him to attack Lee's army with all his force immediately, and that if he was successful in the attack, he might destroy the order, but if he was unsuccessful, he might preserve it for his vindication. The order has never been found. If Meade did receive it, he nonetheless failed to move against Lee. As the days passed, Lincoln began to grow anxious and impatient. Lincoln's worst fears were realized on July 14th, when he received a dispatch from Meade reporting that Lee's army had escaped his grasp by successfully crossing the Potomac at Williamsport, Maryland, into Virginia. At the cabinet meeting that day, Stanton was reluctant to share the news, though his face clearly revealed that he was disturbed, disconcerted. Wells recorded that when asked directly if Lee had escaped, Stanton said abruptly and curtly he knew nothing of Lee's crossing. "I do," said the president emphatically, with a look of painful rebuke to Stanton. Lincoln revealed what he had learned and suggested that the cabinet meeting be adjourned. "Probably none of us were in a right frame of mind for deliberation," Wells wrote. Certainly, he added, the president was not. Lincoln caught up with Wells as his Navy secretary was leaving and walked with him across the lawn. His sorrow that Lee had once again managed to escape was palpable. "On only one or two occasions have I ever seen the president so troubled, so dejected and discouraged," Wells wrote. "Our army held the war in the hollow of their hand, and they would not close it," Lincoln said later. "We had gone through all the labor of tilling and planting an enormous crop, and when it was ripe, we did not harvest it." Later that afternoon, Lincoln wrote a frank letter to General Meade. While expressing his profound gratitude for the magnificent success at Gettysburg, he acknowledged that he was distressed immeasurably by the magnitude of the misfortune involved in Lee's escape. "He was within your easy grasp, and to have closed upon him would, in connection with our other late successes, have ended the war. As it is, the war will be prolonged indefinitely." Before sending the letter, which he knew would leave Meade disconsolate, Lincoln held back, as he often did when he was upset or angry, waiting for his emotions to settle. In the end, he placed the letter in an envelope inscribed, "To General Meade, never sent or signed." Lincoln later told Connecticut Congressman Henry C. Deming that Meade's failure to attack Lee after Gettysburg was one of three occasions when better management upon the part of the commanding general might have terminated the war. The other two command failures he attributed to McClellan during the Peninsula Campaign and Hooker at Chancellorsville. Still, he acknowledged, "I do not know that I could have given any different orders had I been with them myself. I have not fully made up my mind how I should behave when mini balls were whistling and those great oblong shells shrieking in my ear. I might run away." Troubling events in New York City soon diverted the nation's attention. For weeks, authorities had worried about the potential for violence on July 11th. On that date, the names of all the men eligible for the first draft in American history would be placed in a giant wheel and drawn randomly until the prescribed quota was filled. The unpopular idea of coercing men to become soldiers had provided traction for Copperhead politicians. Speaking on July 4th, Governor Seymour had told an immense crowd that the federal government had exceeded its constitutional authority by forcing men into an ungodly conflict waged on behalf of the black man. The antagonistic Daily News, read by the majority of working-class Irish, claimed that the purpose of the draft was to kill off Democrats. A provision in the Conscription Act that allowed a draftee to either pay $300 or provide a substitute provoked further discontent. Both Stanton and Lincoln had objected to this feature of the bill, but Congress had insisted. Opponents of the draft gained powerful ammunition that this was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. Still, the first day of the draft proceeded peacefully, leaving the city woefully unprepared for the violent uprising that accompanied the spinning of the wheel on the second day. Scarcely had two dozen names been called, the New York Times reported, when a crowd, numbering perhaps 500, stormed the building with clubs, stones, brickbats, and other missiles. Entering through the broken windows, they stoned the drafting officers, smashed the giant wheel, shredded the lists and records, and then set the building on fire. Returning to the street, the mob, composed mainly of poor Irish immigrants, turned its vengeance against anyone it encountered. It seemed to be an understood thing, the Times reporter noted, that the Negroes should be attacked wherever found, whether they offered any provocation or not. As soon as one of these unfortunate people was spied, whether on a cart, a railroad car, or in the street, he was immediately set upon by a crowd of men and boys. Terror unfolded as the rioters beat their victims to death, and then strung their bodies on trees. An orphanage for black children was burned to the ground. Hundreds of stores were looted, and dozens of policemen lost their lives. More than 1,000 people were killed or wounded. The riots continued unchecked for 5 days, becoming the all-engrossing topic of conversation in Washington. The inability of the authorities to restore law and order prompted Chase to announce his desire to have the power for a week. The mob violence finally ended when a regiment of soldiers, returning from Pennsylvania, entered the city. Although some advised Lincoln to suspend the draft indefinitely, he insisted that it go forward. The turmoil in New York created foreboding throughout the North as other cities prepared to commence their own drafts. In the days preceding Auburn's draft on July 23rd, Francis Seward lived in daily apprehension of a riot. In frequent letters to her husband, she reported that copperheads were spreading malicious stories, blaming Seward's higher law for the riots in New York. Tensions in Auburn escalated when several Irishmen fought with blacks, resisted arrest, and threatened to destroy the Seward home. Frances awoke one morning to find that a large rock had been thrown into the room where she regularly sat to read. After discovering the damage, she advised her daughter-in-law to remove anything she considered valuable. "So that afternoon," Jenny recalled, "I took my husband's photograph down to my mother's house, it being, to my mind, the most valuable thing that I possessed." From Washington, Seward sought to placate his wife. "Do not give yourself a thought about the house. There will hardly be anybody desperate enough to do you personal harm, and if the country, in its unwonted state of excitement, will destroy our home, the sacrifice will be a small one for our country, and not without benefit." Frances persevered, retaining her calm during these difficult days, as she had done years before during the trial of William Freeman. "As to personal injury," she told her husband, "I fear more for the poor colored people than for others. They cannot protect themselves, and few persons are willing to assist them." On the morning of Auburn's draft, Frances reported to her son Fred that while everyone was somewhat anxious, she was feeling more secure, since the local citizenry had organized a volunteer police force. The New York Times reported the successful results of the efforts in Auburn. "The best of order was observed, and the best spirit was manifested by the 2,000 citizens who had gathered to witness the draft. As local officials addressed patriotic speeches to the crowd, the drafted men cheered for the Union, Old Abe, the draft, and our recent victories." Even before such reassuring accounts reached him, Seward had predicted that the disturbances in New York, like a thunder shower, would clear the political skies of the storms that the Copperheads had been gathering up a long time. His words proved prescient, for when the loss of life and property was tallied in the wake of the New York riots, public opinion turned against Governor Seymour. His incendiary 4th of July speech was seen by many as a direct incitement to the people to resist the government. John Hay learned from a visiting New Yorker that Seymour was in a terrible state of nervous excitement precipitated both by the terrible reminiscence of the riots and the virulent condemnation by the press for his handling of the situation. The news that Seymour had lost ground immensely with a large number of the best men engendered great satisfaction in the Lincoln administration. And when the draft was eventually resumed in New York City, everything went smoothly. "The nation is great, brave, and generous," Seward confidently told Francis. "All will go on well, and though not without the hindrance of faction at every step, yet it will go through to the right and just end. How differently the nation has acted thus far in the crisis from what it did in 1850 to 1860. Within 24 distressing hours, the president had learned of both Lee's escape and the disgraceful riots in New York. Nonetheless, he was able to shake off his gloom within a matter of days. On Sunday morning, July 19th, Hay reported that the president was in very good humor. He had written a humorous verse mocking the pomp and mighty swell with which Lee had gone forth to sack Philadelphia. While he remained fully cognizant of the consequences of Lee's escape, he had willed himself to reconsider his outlook on General Meade and the Battle of Gettysburg. "A few days having passed," he assured one of Meade's commanding generals, "I am now profoundly grateful for what was done, without criticism for what was not done. General Meade has my confidence as a brave and skillful officer and a true man." Oddly enough, Lincoln's good spirits that Sunday morning were due in part to the 6 straight hours he had spent with Hay the previous day reviewing 100 courts-martial. Whereas the young secretary was in a state of entire collapse after the ordeal, Lincoln found relief and renewed vigor as he exercised the power to pardon. As they went through the cases, Hay marveled at the eagerness with which the president caught at any fact which would justify him in saving the life of a condemned soldier. Confronted with soldiers who had been sentenced to death for cowardice, Lincoln typically reduced the sentence to imprisonment or hard labor. "It would frighten the poor devils too terribly to shoot them," he said. One case involved a private who was sentenced to be shot for desertion, though he had later re-enlisted. Lincoln simply proposed, "Let him fight instead of shooting him." Lincoln acknowledged to General John Eaton that some of his officers believed he employed the pardoning power with so much freedom as to demoralize the army and destroy the discipline. "Although officers only see the force of military discipline," he explained, "he tried to comprehend it from the vantage of individual soldiers, a picket so exhausted that sleep steals upon him unawares, a family man who overstayed his leave, a young boy overcome by a physical fear greater than his will." He liked to tell of a soldier who, when asked why he had run away, said, "Well, Captain, it was not my fault. I have got just as brave a heart as Julius Caesar. But these legs of mine will always run away with me when the battle begins." Rather than fearing that he had overused his pardoning power, Lincoln feared he had made too little use of it. He could not bear the sound of gunshot on the days when deserters were executed. Only where meanness or cruelty were shown, did he exhibit no clemency. Yet even as he plowed through one court-martial after another, Lincoln's humor remained intact. At one point he was handed the case of a captain charged with looking through keyholes and over transoms at a lady undressing. He laughingly suggested that the captain be elevated to the peerage, so that he could be accorded the appropriate title, Count Peeper. The summer of 1863 brought the hottest weather Washington had suffered in many years. "Men and horses dropping dead in the streets every day," Hay reported to Nicolay, who had escaped to the Rocky Mountains. "The garments cling to the skin," one resident observed. Shirt collars are laid low. Moisture oozes from every object, standing in clammy exudation upon iron, marble, wood, and human flesh. The air is pervaded with a faint odor, as of withered bouquets and dead mint juleps, and the warm steam of a home washing day is over everything. Stanton found the hot, dusty weather the most disagreeable he had ever experienced. Burning sun all day, sultry at night. Ellen Stanton had escaped with her children for the summer, leaving her husband alone in Washington. Writing to her at a mountain retreat in Bedford, Pennsylvania, Stanton acknowledged that all is silent and lonely, but there is consolation in knowing that you and the children are free from the oppressive heat and discomfort of Washington. Nearly everybody, except the members of the unfortunate Can't Get Away Club, has gone to the seaside or countryside, Noah Brooks reported. Truly, the season is one of languor, lassitude, and laziness. And even the reporters have nearly all followed the example of better men and have likewise skedaddled from the heat. As soon as Mary felt well enough to travel, she too fled the capital with both Tad and Robert, commencing a 2-month sojourn in New York, Philadelphia, and the White and Green Mountains. The cool breezes of New Hampshire and Vermont would prove beneficial to young Tad, whose health remained fragile, while the lure of a resort hotel in the mountains kept Robert by her side through most of August. A correspondent who caught up with her at Tip Top, Mount Washington, was delighted with her very easy, agreeable manner and her very fair, cheerful, smiling face. Only a dozen short telegrams between the Lincolns remain from that summer. In these brief communications, Lincoln talked about the heat, shared news of the Kentucky elections, and asked her to let dear Tad know that his nanny goat had run away and left his father in distress about it. Only in mid-September, as the time drew near for Mary's return, did Lincoln admit that he had missed her, repeating in 2 separate telegrams his eagerness to be reunited with her and with Tad. Mary understood that he was not given to letter writing, and so long as she was assured of his good health, she remained content. The Lincolns' undemonstrative communications stand in marked contrast to the effusive letters the Sewards exchanged all summer, openly sharing their feelings about the family, the war, and the country. I wish I could gain from some other source the confidence with which you inspire me when I am with you, Frances told her husband. I need it in these disastrous times. The loyalty of the people is now to be put to the test. Seward urged her to be calm and confident. Every day since the war broke out, we have drawn on the people for 1,000 men, and they have gone to the field. To her husband, Frances acknowledged that while the country rejoiced over the victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, she despaired when she read the lists of killed and wounded. Only with Frances could the stalwart Seward reveal his own distress, confusion, and exhaustion. While Lincoln spent hours writing letters to keep generals and politicians on an even keel, he apparently never found the solace Seward and Chase took in their extensive family correspondence. Nor did his wife and children write regularly. Tad, a slow learner, may not have developed the skill to easily compose letters. Robert, then entering his junior year at Harvard, surely was capable of penning descriptions of his days in the mountains. Very different in temperament, Lincoln and his eldest son never seemed to develop a close relationship. During Robert's childhood, Lincoln had been absent for months at a time, traveling the circuits of both politics and law. At 16, Robert entered boarding school in New Hampshire, and he was a student at Harvard when his father became president. Thenceforth, Robert noted sadly, any great intimacy between us became impossible. I scarcely even had 10 minutes quiet talk with him during his presidency, on account of his constant devotion to business. For Lincoln, it was enough to know that his wife and sons were happily ensconced at the Equinox House in Manchester, Vermont, then considered a primary summer resort, providing access to fishing, nature walks, gardens, swimming holes, concerts, croquet, archery, and excellent dining facilities. During the visit, Mary climbed a mountain, socialized with General Doubleday and his wife, and enjoyed the clear, refreshing air. Kate Chase would remember the summer of 1863 less for its record-breaking heat than for her rekindled romance with William Sprague, elected earlier in the year to the U.S. Senate. When the young millionaire came to Washington to take his seat, he called on Kate, and their troubled past was soon forgotten. "We did again join hands, and again join fortunes," Sprague later said. In early May, Sprague invited Kate to visit his estate in Providence, Rhode Island, so that she would meet his family and see his immense manufacturing company. Running at full tilt, the company's 10,000 employees could turn out 35,000 pieces of print cloth weekly, with the 280,000 spindles and 28 printing machines in the factories. "I want to show you how to make calico from cotton," he told Kate. "You are a statesman's daughter, will doubtless be a statesman's wife, and who, if not you, should know how things are done, not how only they are undone or destroyed." Shortly after they returned to Washington, Sprague asked Chase for Kate's hand in marriage. "The Gov and Miss Kate have consented to take me into their fold," Sprague proudly reported to a friend in New York. Sprague's adoration for Kate is clear from the flood of letters he wrote during the first months of their engagement. "The business which takes my time, my attention, my heart, my all," he wrote, "is of a certain young lady who has become so entwined in every pulsation that my former self has lost its identity. Without her," he confessed, "his life seemed a wilderness, a blank." He kept her miniature by his side and waited for her return letters, as a drowning man seizing at anything to sustain him. A 5-day separation seemed an age to him, so strong a hold had she gained upon his heart. Even when they were both in Washington, he sent her loving notes from his room at the Willard Hotel. "I am, my darling, up and in sympathy with the sunshine," he wrote early one morning. And another morning, "I hope, my darling, you are up, feeling fresh and happy. Knowing that you are so is happiness to me. I kiss you good morning and adieu." Kate's attachment to Sprague, however, did not indicate a readiness to leave her father. Nor was Chase, despite his claims, prepared to